against China was in the making since the beginning of the century. The Quad was first established by then-President George W. Bush following the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami and, after a long hiatus, was reconvened by Donald Trump in 2017. Its advertised aim was fostering a free, open and inclusive Indo-Pacific region, but the implicit goal was to address concerns about Beijing's growing economic influence, military prowess and technological heft. Although this year's virtual meeting focused on non-military initiatives and China was never mentioned in any statements or proceedings, the Quad has the potential to further divide the already complex geopolitical arrangement of Asia. Its extension, or the Quad Plus, including France, Canada and perhaps the United Kingdom or New Zealand, may prompt a counter-axis with Russia or Pakistan in tandem with China.
India and three other Quad countries have recently kicked off a major naval exercise along with France in the Bay of Bengal. Such drills may be seen as a show of military might by these countries who don't mention it but are apparently concerned about China's growing military. But Quad wants to be more than that. The members of the Quad and some of their friends believe the baby alliance has also the bandwidth to challenge non-security frontiers of Beijing's global influence.
The March 12th summit wrapped up with no direct reference to China, but the joint statement by Quad's four leaders was telling of a different story. The Quad leaders established working groups about COVID-19 vaccine development as well as cooperation in emerging technologies plus climate change. On the first glance, they seem irrelevant to China, but they are aimed at addressing the broader aspects of Beijing's central position in the global system. China is a pivotal player in international supply chains. This had never been so noticeable for the Quad members before the pandemic necessitated universal vaccine production and distribution. The Quad seeks to restructure supply chains to wean them away from Beijing. Another Quad initiative is to undercut China's influence in telecom and biotech. And climate activism is only there for the global appeal. All of these members have other bilateral or multilateral alliances or pacts specifically for the promulgated goals of Quad. They did not deliver, so what makes them expect a different result from a new name or clothing?
Now, to learn more about Quad and its purpose and aims, we have with us Mr. Victor Gao. He's the chair and professor of Suzhou University and the vice president of CCG. Mr. Gao, welcome to the program. So, what are the consequences of the formation of Quad, or as some call it, Asian NATO? Can we even call it an Asian NATO?
First of all, I think the fundamental premise for the formation of Quad, that is an informal alliance involving the United States, Japan, India and Australia, is very much misplaced. Why? Because I think in the world of today, people want to have peace and development rather than having a resurgence of another Cold War or a conflict leading to a total war. And from the Chinese perspective, any attempt by one country or several countries to form a so-called alliance to contain China will be a failure, because it's impossible to contain a big and great country like China with 1.4 billion people bent upon peace and development. And China is now contributing anywhere roughly around one-third of any additional GDP growth for any given year in recent years. Therefore, to contain China and try to stop China's peaceful economic development is suicidal for the United States and other countries. Therefore, I think Quad, if it is designed to contain China, will be a miserable failure. And you can call Quad by any other name, for example, Asian NATO, for example, it will not be a success. It will not deliver the results that its member countries want to see it deliver.
All right, so you think it's a failure and it would be suicidal. Now, Can India use Quad for its own gains?
I think you need to ask Indian government or some experts in India for this question. From our perspective, I think India is a developing country, it's a non-aligned country. It will serve India's interest better if it continues its non-aligned position, because that's really the core and the strength of Indian diplomacy for the past several decades. Secondly, India can really do a big favor for its own people and its own government if it maintains a focus on peace and stability and maintain good neighborly relations with its neighbors, including with China. China does not want to have a conflict or a war or confrontation with India. Both China and India are great countries with Asian histories, and we share a very long land boundary with each other. And both China and India need better investments and need to do more to improve the living standards of the Chinese people on the one hand and the Indian people on the other hand. We do not want to have a war. A war is not good for China. The war is not good for India. So let's talk peace rather than talk about war.
Now, how would China see or react to such a potential alliance?
Now, first of all, I don't think there is such an alliance to start with. What they are talking about is a very loose structure with no written document endorsed by their parliaments elevating their relationship into an alliance. No, it's not an alliance, a very loose structure to start with. Secondly, I don't think these countries or these people really want to contain China. Why? Because it's a mission impossible. How can you contain a very big, important country, the biggest contributor to the global economic growth, the largest population in the world, and one of the strongest military in the world? So I think these countries will realize, including their people and their government, they will realize the futility of such attempt to contain China and the destructiveness of the attempt to set up a so-called alliance involving these four countries. These four countries aligned together will not be able to defeat China or hold China to the ground. They are talking about complete indulgence in fantasies rather than talking about realities on the ground. Chinese government and the Chinese people do not want to have a war or conflict with any of these four countries. We want to have peace with them. We want to talk about business and cooperation and economic and financial cooperation included, for example. So we have better things to talk about rather than war or conflict or confrontation.
All right, that's a very interesting point. Now, isn't the Quad just another way of America to have military presence in the region?
Well, the United States is very much the mastermind of Quad, whatever it means and whatever it will evolve into. And I think the United States is really very much losing its own sanity over the rapid economic development over the past decades and the economic disparity between the United States on the one hand and China on the other hand is very fast narrowing. As of the end of last year, China is already about 70%, if not a little bit more, than the United States, compared with the United States in terms of the overall size of the GDP, if we use official exchange rate as the benchmark. And there are lots of economists who are talking about that by another 10 years, if not even less, the Chinese economy, if we use the official exchange rate as the benchmark, will surpass that of the United States. And I think in China, we are very much confident that given the unity of China, given the strong leadership of China, the execution ability, delivery capacities of the Chinese government, and the overall support of the Chinese people for the peace and development strategies adopted by the Chinese government, China will surpass the economic size of the United States in about 10 years, if not even less. But does that mean that China wants to replace the United States as the top dog in the world? No, I don't think the Chinese government or the Chinese people want to be the top dog of the world. We want to see a world in a multilateral format, and every country, big or small, will be treated as an equal sovereign. And that's very, very important. And I think we all need to rally behind the United Nations, and we should not do anything to bully other countries, to violate the legitimate interests of the other countries, and to put yourself on top of the United Nations.
All right, thank you so much, Mr. Gao, for being with us on our program. It was very nice having you. Before moving ahead, let's just take a quick look at what's been going on cyberspace and social media.
Ronald Van Keekum has talked about the NATO-style alliance against China. Tom Fowdy has made fun of US double standard policies. He highlighted that Washington is only a friend to India in its rivalry against China and nowhere else. Navendra Tripathi called Quad the first step in the formation of a bigger front against China. Rab Rakha believes China should counter a threat such as Quad, and he believes it starts with doing something about India. Memory has tweeted a quote by a Chinese professor downgrading the Quad.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
In India, more than 20 policemen were killed in a recent ambush by Maoist militants in the mineral-rich state of Chhattisgarh. This came about a month after another similar attack by Maoist Naxal militants who have been waging attacks since 1967. The recent rise of Maoist attacks in India has revived concerns about this decades-old insurgency that has appeared largely contained. What does this resurgence mean for India?
Maoist militants, often referred to as Naxalite or Naxals, trace their roots to communist politics. They use violence against the state in the name of championing the cause of India's poor and marginalized. Naxalite groups have been active in the country since the 1960s, but the modern insurgency did not begin until the early 2000s. Since 1967, the group has asserted control over vast swaths of land in central and eastern India, establishing a so-called Red Corridor. The reach of the outfit was once so widespread and their attacks so frequent that in 2006, India's Prime Minister declared them the country's single biggest internal security challenge. The Indian government has hunted many of the insurgent leaders, killing a large number or forcing them to surrender. This, along with years of infighting, has declined the insurgent attacks in frequency and potency. Nevertheless, the group continues to launch hit-and-run attacks, ambushing security forces in friendly terrain and inflicting casualties in deadly battles.
According to data by the South Asia Terrorism Portal, over 100 people have been killed this year, and it's only April now. More than 2,100 civilians in India have been killed in the Maoist insurgency since 2010. The government's inability to contain such a homegrown insurgency has a heavy and bloody cost for the civilians and security personnel alike in areas under their reach. And the prospects for peace look dim because these areas are among the poorest in the country. bad living conditions feed such an insurgency.
Although the insurgency has largely weakened since the 2010s, the well-planned ambush of this march and incidents of this kind are far from a novelty in the Maoist hotbeds. The change of Maoist leadership in late 2018 was seen as the return to increasingly aggressive tactics, such as assassinations of prominent figures and multi-pronged hits. But the ongoing pandemic seems to have impacted the insurgents' supply lines, thus hindering further attacks. The Indian government needs a coherent, long-term remedial approach. The current situation is paradoxical. Authorities turn to military force saturation and rely on disproportionate kinetic responses in Maoist-prone tribal areas. This keeps these regions underdeveloped and inhabitants unhappy, which in turn boost Maoist recruitments.
Now, to have more insight about the Naxalites and the Maoist insurgency in India, we are joined by Colonel Danveer Singh, who is an associate editor of the Indian Defence Review. Mr. Singh, welcome to the program. So, what do Maoists in India really want? Are they a serious threat?
Okay, this is a very interesting question because generally people think that it is a movement of some sort of separatism. So, let me make it very, very clear that Maoist movement is not a separatist movement. It is a movement for regime change. These people follow the ideology of Mao from China, and they are not happy with the democratic system prevailing in India. They say that it is a capitalist system that exists in India, inherited from the Britishers. It oppresses the weak and the poor, and the oppression is by the capitalist people. And the state is representative of these oppressors. So Maoists want to free the country from the oppressors per se, and they want to establish communist rule exactly on the line of the Chinese Communist Party. So this is what their whole agenda and idea about this insurgency or this violence is.
The cost of government's inability to control the Maoists are the lives of the people. How can India handle the Maoist insurgency?
See, this Maoist insurgency is to be handled on various fronts. I personally feel, very firstly, it is to be handled at social level, wherein the people, affected people or the people who reside in jungles and remote areas, they have to be provided by some kind of social security. When we talk of social security, it involves medical, it involves food, it involves various other amenities that other people do enjoy. Then we have to carry out administrative reforms, because administrative reforms are key to building a trustworthy connect between the poor, downtrodden, and those who are ruling or the system. So to integrate system with the people, you have to carry out administrative reforms. And administrative reforms are absolutely necessary because they are very archaic. We have inherited these systems from the British. They are not Indian system. They are not sensitive to the local way of thinking and living. So that is another point. Then we graduate on to other aspects of military. That is, we have to counter the propaganda war of the Maoists with great intensity. And lastly, we have to carry out friendly operations, military operations that do not harm the locals, but they target the Maoists. So we have to function on various levels, like I mentioned, to repeat them again. We have social, administrative, information, and military. So these are the four prongs that we have to invoke to counter the Maoist strategy. Otherwise, Maoists will continue to have their grip on the very low and far-flung strata living in the jungles of central India.
Now, during the time of Premier Manmohan Singh, it was believed that Naxalites or Naxalism was the greatest threat to Indian internal security. Do you think it is still the case?
As I mentioned, what Manmohan Singh had said in 2010 was absolute a reality, because that was a time when all the disturbed areas combined, that is to do with the northeastern region, Kashmir, and the Maoist Red Corridor, it almost made up to 70% of India's landmass. That was very huge. That was extremely huge. So when he said that, that was a very right thing that he said that. Now things have changed. While the India still be 70% in a sense that the ideology or the Maoist ideology still resonates in the corners, but when it comes to Maoist insurgency, it is not. It is not that 70%. In that 70%, I included Northeast as well. So today, when we are talking, Northeast is virtually or literally free of insurgency, literally free. And Maoist insurgency out of 6-7 states, it has reduced and is confined to a very limited area of a small state called Chhattisgarh. That is all. Kashmir insurgency has also come down drastically, which is also on the verge of complete collapse, because it is also breathing its last. So when we look at the complete scenario and that 70% that I quoted, I don't think so. It is more than 10 to 15% as you and me are talking.
All right, Mr. Singh, thank you so much for being with us on our show. It was really nice having you here. Now, before ending, let's just take a quick look at the social media and cyberspace and what they think about the Naxalites and what's going on in India. Thank you.
Siddharth Kaushal believes that the Indian government should do whatever it can to contain the Maoist insurgency. ARI Videos has shared videos to commemorate all those killed in Maoist attacks. This account with the handle Global Cyber Police says, with proper resources, he can eradicate the Maoist insurgency.
And this concludes our episode on the Quad Summit and the Maoist insurgency in India. We shall meet next week.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, peace be upon him, advised Muslims to cling to silence. He ordered them to refrain from saying useless words. He, peace be upon him, said, "Indeed, this tongue is the key of all good and evil. So the believer must seal his tongue as he seals his gold and silver. For Allah's apostle, may Allah bless him and his family, said, may Allah have mercy of the believer who restrains his tongue from all evil, for that is alms from him for himself. No one is safe from sins unless he restrains his tongue.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we find that Islam is a beautiful religion which has been prescribed by Allah, who is the creator of all that is created, who is the creator of all that is in existence. Islam is a religion, is a beautiful religion for that matter. It is a perfect and complete religion. It is the ultimate truth which has been prescribed by Allah in order to perfect humanity. Now, one of the ways in which this perfection of humanity takes place is, of course, via how people behave with one another. You can't have a perfect society if everybody is fighting one another and killing one another and destroying each other's property and stealing and lying and cheating and backbiting. Of course not. That sounds like a pretty horrible society, to be honest with you. A beautiful society is based upon the beautiful manners and the beautiful behaviors and the beautiful social etiquettes that people have with one another. And honestly, I think that one of the things that shows the beauty of a religion is the way that the religion asks people to behave with one another. So we find in the dialogues of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, where he talks to his companions about these very social Islamic etiquettes on how to treat one another. Imam al-Baqir says to his companion Jabir al-Jufi, in this conversation on what Islamic social etiquettes are, Imam al-Baqir says that your strong ones should help your weak ones, and your rich ones should be kind, should help your poor ones. Two sentences, dear friends, but two sentences that has a whole world, a whole universe of meaning and complexity, and such a profound prescription for perfection of humanity in general. The first one, your strong ones, your powerful ones, your ones who have leadership position, your ones who have a powerful positions, your leaders, your presidents, your prime ministers. Unfortunately, because of some countries' backward systems, your kings, your rulers, your managers, your supervisors, your strong ones should help your weak ones. We can take this sentence and talk about it for hours. Unfortunately, I only have a few seconds. But your strong ones should help your weak ones, help the poor, help the weak, help the disenfranchised, help the 99%, help the people starving across the world, help the people who are being oppressed across the world. Power and responsibility and duty and position and status should not be a means to oppress and subdue and dominate and subjugate. Rather, the strong ones should use their strength to improve and make humanity perfect. And the other one, your rich ones should be kind to your poor ones. The rich among society must, and again I say must, help the poor within society. the Islamic social etiquettes brought to us in this conversation, which can truly, truly perfect humanity given to us by Allah in the words of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Saudagar.
To try to relate our condition to the conditions of Imam al-Baqir, see some parallels, although it's not exactly the same. We do have some differences here. But I'm going to focus on the similarities. And then look at Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, what he presented. There's a methodology that he presented. We are living at a time where the knowledge of Islam is something that there are many people who want to follow it. There are many people who desire to know what the teachings of the Prophet are, what the Quran says, and they want to follow Islam. There are many who claim to follow it, but overall, there is a state of confusion. The reason why this is happening, or what this is a result of, is very similar to the time of Imam al-Baqir. Not necessarily for the same reasons, but the conditions are very similar. The conditions are that resources, the accurate knowledge of what the Ahlul Bayt have said, what the Holy Prophet has said, what even the Quran says is not available. In Imam al-Baqir's time, salamullahi alayhi, and prior to him, Imam Zain al-Abidin's time, the Quran is available. Everybody, and there, we're talking about a region where in Iraq and in Medina, in where the Imams were, was predominantly even Medina. That's an Arab, that's where Arabia is. They're all Arabs. The word of God is in Arabian Mubin, is in clear Arabic, it says. Yet, what the Quran says in terms of teachings is not very clear. There's different notions, different ideas, even in terms of what it's referring to. Many times the Quran does not state who this is. Names are not mentioned. وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَشْرِي نَفْسَهُ ابْتِغَاءَ مَرْضَاتِ اللَّهِ. Of people, there are those who have given up themselves for God's pleasure. Who is this? Although there's a general teaching there that applies to anyone that wishes to do so, there are people that are such.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In that permission, Shaheed said, after praising Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he says that our respectable son Hujjatul Islam wal Muslimin Sayyid Mahmud Hashimi has spent a long time of his life learning fiqh, usul and theological studies, so that he has succeeded to become a mujtahid on whom Islam and the Muslims may rely.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was living in Najaf. This was because, I mean, the ex-Baathist regime hadn't devastated the whole Najaf seminary. And another one is that Najaf was in some way the hub of all the Shiite world.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher and analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding jurists, philosophers, and thinkers of the Nation of Islam all across the world. I'm Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakh Rouhani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, Doctor.
Assalamu alaikum.
And Sayyid Mohsen Nawi, an Islamic scholar from the Islamic House of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother. Welcome.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So today we want to continue our discussion regarding the character of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Hashimi Shahrudi. In our previous discussions, we talked about his lineage, his background, and his scholarly and academic, you know, character, especially his main fields of studies in the terms of Islamic principles, usul al-fiqh, fiqh. We can say he was one of the students and one of maybe the best students among the best students of Shaheed Muhammad Baqir Assad. But Sayyid Mohsen Nawi, regarding the political life and the political activities of Ayatollah Mahmud Hashimi Shahrudi, both in Iraq and Iran, there are so many documents. He was a political activist in both Iraq at the time of Baath regime and then in Iran. Talk a little bit about his political activities for us, brother.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, as we know that he was one of the most prominent and close students of Shaheed Saad.
Exactly.
Since Shaheed Saad has Hizbut Da'wah, which was against the Ba'ath regime, and they have these activities, Ayatollah Shahrudi was also involved in those activities from the very beginning. But we can see, like, even in the history that in 1974, the Ba'ath regime, because of his activities that he had against the Ba'ath regime and the Saddam's regime, they imprisoned him, and he was in prison.
Okay.
After that, we see that when the Islamic Revolution occurred in 1979, first late Ahmad Khomeini was the link between the Imam Khomeini and Shaheed Saad, and later it was Ayatollah Shahrudi,
okay,
late Shahrudi, who was a link between them, and he used to, you know, bring the messages for Shaheed Saad. And if I want to just quickly summarize the activities that he had in Iraq, after the martyrdom of Shaheed Sadr, basically he became a prominent leader for the Iraqi, we can say Shias, or the those who were against the Ba'ath regime. And
at the time of Ba'ath regime, the Shias were banned from holding gatherings.
Kind of, yes.
So there were great ulamas on that time in Hawza. Hawza was active on that time in Basra?
Hawza was active, and that was only for the educational cause. So they couldn't have the political, you know, speeches. Same was the case in Iran as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like at the time of the Shah Pahlavi, It was allowed for the scholars to have their lectures in the Hausa, but they were not allowed to talk about politics.
Okay.
You know, this was the secular thinking was within these, we can say, the secular thinking was within these, you know, rulers of the time.
That's right.
And what made Imam Khomeini prominent from other scholars at the time of, you know, before the revolution, it was that Imam Khomeini raised his voice against the things that were going on in the country.
That's right.
And he basically got involved in the politics of the country. Same is the case with the Shahid Sadr in Iraq.
That's right.
Why Saddam killed Shahid Sadr? Because he came and he basically started talking about the politics.
That's right.
And he was basically intervening in the political issues of
That's
that time for the weak, you know, people of the Iraqi, like the Iraqi people. And we can see the same activities that late Ayatollah Shahroudi followed the same
That's
footsteps
right.
of his teachers.
We get to Majlis Ala, you know, in Iraq by Ayatollah Hashemi Shahroudi, established by him, in fact. Dr. Fakhwani, brother, you yourself had many travels to Iraq, especially the cities of Najaf and Karbala. And we know that the Ba'ath regime had such a pressure over there. They martyred so many members of the great families, scholarly families in Iraq, and banned so many others. Ayatollah Hashemi Shahroudi was among, we can say, those scholars who had to leave the country, Iraq, for Iran because of the Ba'ath pressures over there. Talk a little bit about the political atmosphere of Iraq during the Ba'ath regime and Saddam regime, and why Ayatollah Shahroudi left over there.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In order to discuss this point, it's necessary to go back and to refer to what our brother Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi has already referred to. We find that when shortly after the 1920 revolution in Iraq, we find that several dynasties, I mean Arab dynasties, came to power in Iraq, mainly in Baghdad. At first, a great majority of them had British leanings, and later on, with the upcoming of the ex-Soviet powers, we find that leftists and Marxists got to power. Okay, now we find that, apart from the Sunni populated areas of Iraq, when we come to the Shia parts, we find that leftists and especially communists, Marxists, wanted to propagate the teachings in the Shia populated areas. At this time, we find that among the great and renowned ulamas in Najaf, we find that the late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr was one of the most prodigious scholars who felt this threat and developed many books. And the back scenario of his writing the book Falsafatuna, of philosophy, was that the late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr wanted to highlight that the Islamic creedal system and the Islamic mindset is much superior to other frameworks already presented to people.
That's
as
right.
The savior of nations.
Okay.
At that time, because the ex-Ba'athist regime had apparently leftist inclinations and leanings, but in fact they were connected both to Americans and to Russians.
Okay.
And for the intelligence system, they benefited from the British and the Zionists at the same time.
Okay.
They benefited from everywhere who were against Islam. They felt the threat of the late Shahid Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, and not only the threat of the Shahid Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, but also the threat they felt from the close associates of the late Shahid Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
Including Ayatollah Shahroudi.
Yes,
That's
exactly.
Right. Okay.
We find that first they arrested and then martyred the late Shahid Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, and almost at the same time or shortly afterward, they wanted to follow up and to chase and pursue the close associates of the late Ayatollah Shahid Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. And it's because of this that the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahroudi first from Iraq went to Kuwait, and then from Kuwait he migrated back to Iran, okay, to his paternal homeland.
And were there any member of the family members of Ayatollah Shahroudi martyred in Iran?
There were three brothers.
Really?
Yes.
His three brothers,
wow.
They got martyred by the by the Ba'ath regime, and they were involved in the political activities at that time.
Ayatollah Shardi's three brothers were martyrs.
Yes.
Wow. And they were students in Baghdad, at the University of Baghdad.
One of them was a student, another had a business.
Has a business?
Yes, had a business in Karbala.
Okay.
And there was another who was also, I think he was, he also had a business, but they all three, because they were so much active in the riots against the Ba'ath regime.
That's
and
right.
in the activities. So first they imprisoned them, and after them, obviously, they got martyred. And the interesting thing is that all three of them, the family has not received till today their dead bodies, and they don't know where they are. They were imprisoned by the Ba'ath regime, and where they took them, no one knows about them.
Yes, it was quite prevalent in Iraq at that time. Okay,
The killing of the scholars and the family
killing
members?
Killing and burning the body and so on.
Oh.
Or, for example, putting the whole body in acids, for example.
Oh.
Yes.
That's all right. So, you know, living under such circumstances in Iraq was really difficult, especially for scholars. We could see, for example, that Islam talks about justice, Islam talks about the human rights and this and that, and then you'd have no chair or no place in order to express yourself, only the academic fields of studies. And was it based on the order or suggestion of Ayatollah Baghir al-Assad that Ayatollah Shardi left Iran?
No, basically it was after the martyrdom of Sheikh Assad.
That's right.
Yes.
Okay,
and it was generally, he basically moved back to Iran, yes, before him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because in 1974, when he got imprisoned, with the reference of a couple of maraji of that time and the pressure of the ulama, he was freed by the Ba'ath regime.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, obviously, I think it was Shahid Baghir al-Sadr as well, like, who basically said to him to move to Iran.
That's right.
And that's how he became the link between the Shahid Sadr and Imam Khomeini.
And what was this Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, which was established by... Was he the main establisher of that?
He was one of the main people who was involved in establishing that.
Okay.
But actually, it was the Hakim family.
Mm-hmm.
And Shahid Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Hakim was the main person who was behind it. And they made this council against the Ba'ath regime, and it was obviously in today's world, we can say at the moment, we can say currently the most of the seats that were taken by a political, we can say, like group in the parliament of Iraq is from the same group. Although the Hakim family was the one who basically started this group, but we can see the first president of this group was late Ayatollah Shahroudi.
Mm-hmm.
And after 30 months, when he moved to Iran, then Sayyid Baqir al-Hakim took
the chairman.
Yes, he became the chairman. After him, his brother Abdul Aziz, and now it's Ammar al-Hakim.
That's right.
Who is the in charge of the group.
So, and this majlis has specific roles, I mean, and on that time especially...
At that time it was against the Ba'ath regime. Also, it has some charitable, we can say, institutes.
Okay.
It is basically, it's supporting the schools.
Right.
It has its own schools.
Okay.
There are the libraries that they built, because, one of the reasons that there was a need of making such a majlis was because the Ba'ath regime wasn't thinking about the welfare of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And since they were not thinking about the welfare of people, and they were just after governing and having their own rulership over the people, so people from inside who had pain for the Iraqi general public,
that's right,
which is mostly from, like, it has come from the same ulama,
okay,
like the scholars in the Najaf and Karbala. So they raised their voice, they started these activities,
right,
and they started to develop the charitable institutes,
mm-hmm,
to help the poor people. They started schools, because schools were not there, especially in the Shia, we can say, like, places where there were more Shias. They were oppressed by these Ba'ath regime, and they never wanted them to be become literate.
Okay.
So that, that's one of the main things about the rulers, the cruel rulers, that they do not want people to get educated, because when they get educated, they can raise their voice against what's happening.
Okay.
So they want them to be illiterate, do not know about anything, and then they can like rule the country.
Right. We know that in Iran, the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Hashemi Shahroudi was the head of the judiciary and the judicial system in Iran, and the new look that he had, I think, at the judicial power in Iran was absolutely based on the Maktab of Shahida Sadr. And, you know, one of the great things that he had done was the change of the concept of imprisonment for the prisoners and the criminals in Iran, because he believed that, according to the Fiqh of Shia, this imprisoning itself has the negative consequences and influence on the soul and the spirit of the people. He tried as best as possible to replace it with the other, we can say, punishments. And the other great things that he had done, you know, regarding the new look that he had in the judicial system in Iran, started with Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Hashemi Shahroudi, and then the next generations of the head of the judiciary system continued that path. Thank you much, Dr. Fakhwani. Nothing to add, brother? This field, okay, and Zaid Mohsen Naghvi, thank you much too for being present in the program. The teacher, it was very kind of you. In three episodes, we tried to cover the character of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Hashemi Shahroudi, may Allah bless his soul. Because of a disease, you know, he passed away. The prayer on his body was led by the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and then his body was taken to the holy shrine of Hazrat Nasrullah in the holy city of Qom, and he was buried in Balasar Mosque in the vicinity of the shrine of Hazrat Nasrullah in the holy city of Qom. May Allah bless his soul, and we really missed him, and we could really benefit from him so much more. And unfortunately, he passed away because of a disease. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen and Dr. Fakhwani, and thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. Do not forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also our YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have two special guests and friends. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, sister.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullahi. I am Sister Nasreen, and I'm happy to be here.
Thank you so very much, Sister Nasreen. Although your accent makes it quite obvious, just for, you know, our listeners to get more in tune with the vibe of our discussion, can I ask where you're from and what you've your studies have been?
I'm born in England, and I am studying Masters in Philosophy of Ethics.
MashaAllah. Thank you so
Applied
very
ethics,
much.
Actually.
Thank you so much for that information. And my other lovely guest is...
Assalamu alaikum, dear sister. I'm Muzaffar Haider from the UK. I'm studying here in the holy city of Qom, studying Islam, and I'm at your service today.
Awesomeness. A joy and a pleasure, you guys. Thank you so very much for joining me on today's discussion. Today we're going to be talking about something that... You know, because of certain ahadith, I feel like Muslims shy away from addressing it, from chasing it, from inspiring toward it. Like ahadith that's, especially from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, where he says, beware of tul al-amal, like far-fetched dreams. Or a hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, where his eminence says, I fear for two things for my ummah after me, one of which is طول الأمل, again, far-fetched dreams. And today we want to talk about dreams of Muslims. Like, as a Muslim person, what kind of dreams and goals do we have? And whether the word dream is even appropriate to be used in this context.
JazakAllah for that. Yeah, no, you did a really good job because you introduced one of the main ideas here, which is fundamental to this discussion, which is this idea of having, you know, طُولُ الْعَمَلِ. And people would translate it as having like fake dreams, you know, these hollow, shallow dreams. I'm going to become this. I'm going to do this in the future. Actually, perhaps a more appropriate translation would be far-fetched hopes. Mm. That's what they're really talking about, right? Far-fetched hopes. One day I'll become a good Muslim. One day I'll do this, right? It's a complete fantasy. Complete fantasy. Why do I say that?
Why do you
because
say that?
The present is all that exists, sister.
True.
This is all we have, right? The past is history. The future is a mystery. Today is a gift. That's why they call it a present.
Did you just quote Kung Fu Panda on this extremely serious show?
But there's a wisdom behind it, right? And that's the reality. Now, dreams are a different thing now. To have dreams, and we're not talking about the types of dreams that you have when you're sleeping, you know, nightmares, and you dream about, I don't know, my brother had a dream that a carrot was chasing him, and he woke up in cold sweats. You know, we're not talking about those kinds of dreams. We're talking about having a dream. You know, having a dream that the world could be a better place.
No, you remind me of someone.
The Martin Luther Jr.
Exactly.
I have a dream.
All right, thank you so much. Sister Nasreen, what is your opinion on this matter of Muslims having dreams, or what? How do you define?
I agree.
Really?
I agree with him. No, I mean, this is the basically, if someone is a practicing Muslim and goes back to the core values of Islam, then our dream is something within, like my dream is that my child becomes a living example for the living imam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the dreams should center around something of reality,
mm-hmm.
and that you work towards those day by day. But we should never sort of have something in the future that is not connected to our behavior today.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be a transformational type of, you know, it's dangerous to use the wrong word, ambition,
definitely.
I suppose. You see, Islam is something that goes back always to development of the self, and eventually goes to the physique, but we won't go into that. But the way that we tend to see things is because is the way that we have been influenced by the secular thinking, which is something outside the self.
For sure.
You know, like a big house.
Mm.
Okay.
This is something that sort of detracts
us from what our actual mission in life, our creation is for. You know, what we've been created for.
Oh. All right, just to...
So I agree.
All right. All right. In conclusion, we agree. We agree with the fact that طول الأمل, not cool, having far-fetched dreams and hopes, because all we have is now, the present time, the today. And there's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali al-Islam that says exactly that. Don't grieve about your yesterday, it's already gone. Don't worry about tomorrow, it may never come. All you have is today, right? And then the next point is that to define dreams and goals and ambitions in an Islamic context, we'd say something that a development process that happens inside me,
mm.
rather than something that's actualized outside of me,
mm.
like a house or a status,
mm-hmm.
or money or zeros in my bank account. But I feel that since we are material beings, unfortunately, I wish